glad to be here, and I really appreciate everybody making the extra effort for the kind of unexpected meeting.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for being so flexible and coming an hour extra for each other meeting, I guess, from now on. So that's great. Hopefully we'll be able to do something more concrete in those hours. So yeah, let's not waste too much time here. So I think the first item today is because we were not done with the last session when Rose gave her talk, so we'll start with the follow-up discussion on applicator training, certification, and licensing. So I know Rose is done with her talk, but did you have still some more questions to ask that are very much pertaining to Rose that we can still... Or Rose, did you have something else to say as well?
Before? Somebody at one point had asked for a copy of our questions, and we, because we have a closed book exam, we don't share our questions with others. People would pay thousands and thousands of dollars for copies of those questions.
That might help fund the state.
And so I just wanted to share that information. Sometimes what we do though is we would sit down in our office at ODA, and if somebody signed a security agreement, if we were revising an exam and we had a group of experts there, that we would sit down with those experts to review those questions if they were pertaining to a subject that maybe we weren't that familiar with, let's say use of termiticides, that if there was some specialized equipment. But on the pollinator ones, we did take them from the PNW publication that Ramesh was involved with, as well as others. And so if somebody reads that publication, then that's where we extract the questions. And so we don't tell people exactly where the questions are the focus, because we want them to read all of that study material. So are there... any questions as far as the types of training or anything?
So yeah, Rose, I have one question. So you talked about some 40 credit hours, right? And 16 credit hours for the applicators. And so I was wondering how much is there for pollinators right now? Are we focusing much on pollinators or?
Well, we have been since 2013, but prior to 2013 there was some, but it wasn't a huge emphasis. Probably our emphasis, it seems like every year we have a new emphasis. We were emphasizing pesticides and water quality, and that was, you know, basically almost all the talks like I gave had to do with protecting salmon. And then this last year it was about protecting bees. And so we kind of go through these phases depending on what is important. And I think that this is really going to spur a lot of more pollinator protection courses. I know that Jeff Jenkins and you, Sajaya, were all involved with giving classes, and certainly ODA.
I was just wondering, can we mandate some more exclusive just pollinator ones for these
exams? Well, we don't have that currently in our law, and most states, when they have tried to do that, it turns into the record-keeping nightmare, because maybe somebody would talk 20 minutes at a presentation about bees. How do you kind of ferret that out? How do you develop a computer system to figure that out? At this point, going through recertification courses, requests for recertification credits is always already like a huge production. And we have, yes, Jeff?
No, I'm if you're done, I have a question. I knew George had one too.
Oh, okay. I think what we would like to do is have a system, which we don't currently have, on our website that if we could code a class for pollinator, code a class for drift, or whatever the important topics are, that if you had an applicator that was specifically looking for a course on that topic, they could find it. At this point, they cannot. If somebody went to our website and they were interested in a class on pollinator protection, they could not figure out where that class was.
Jeff, you had a question?
You have one, George?
Are you following on this, or?
Yeah, just
go ahead.
A slight. So on the test, I haven't seen the test. Do you help the applicants become more familiar with the symbols and label construction? So if they see a B insignia or if they see some other insignia that's more visually oriented, do you help them with that aspect rather than having a deep dive on whatever's a problem today, let alone what's going to be a problem 4 years from now?
Well,
is my question?
Yeah, the exams.
Do you build familiarity?
Yeah, the exams are. It's difficult to have exams because we have paper exams. We have many different centers. We also have electronic to have them constantly updated for the kind of the crisis of the moment. And but we do have information on there as far as the components of the label. The B symbol that you're talking about is so new that it's even not on a lot of pesticide containers yet. But we do have information, some information on that B symbol. Although we have been told by EPA that these labels are going to be changing again. So our questions are more on how to protect bees, comprehension of the label, rather than this is how the pesticide label looks at this moment.
Quick follow-up. I mean, where the good chair had a question specifically about pollinators, my question is not about expressly pollinators. Mm-hmm. It's about helping those folks who are taking that test be looking for and being able to recognize certain symbols that would draw your attention to a sensitivity for either that,
and I'm gonna
that,
add,
that pest or that or
Linda,
that
Linda's been writing bee. The exam, so I'll
am I making any sense?
Yes.
That's a mirror.
I would say so. The newest exams, all of the category specific exams contain a portion of label comprehension where we provide a mock label.
Right.
Okay. And we try and base the mock labels on what you may see out in the marketplace to a large mm-hmm. extent. And so we will ask questions related to those labels specifically. Does that help answer?
I just think when you're, it can be relatively good at math and do well on the test, but doesn't mean that sense goes with math.
And a lot of those questions aren't math-related questions. They are questions related to how
comprehension,
reading the label, understanding, finding things on the label. There may be some math related to that, but if there are sections about say buffer zones, drift components, pollinator protection that we put on those labels, you may find that in questions.
The reason I bring this up, and I actually do have a point to all this, that if we're going to be accumulating some recommendations that not only go to the state legislature, but could also go to our delegation about perceived or needed changes mm-hmm. in label clarity, then there's no reason for us to be constricted with just a legislative purview. We can make a greater recommendation.
Yeah, great point. But again, the follow-up, I think your part of your question is also asking whether ODA trains these people or not, right? They're testing, basically. I don't think ODA has a program to train these people for.
No, I wasn't focusing so much on the training side, but I was more focused on making sure that we're building a comprehension that is beyond a single language, So you have a lot of folks that English is not their primary language, that they have a relatively good chance of understanding a label, and that comprehension could be a couple different, done a couple different ways. Thank you. Sorry, I was speaking away from
you. Do you want to ask?
Go on.
You had a question for us?
Well, the issue of comprehension, training, and all that with people who are actually licensed or required to be licensed is one thing, but I wanted to concentrate my question on those people who are not required to be licensed. It seems to me that we have a pretty big loophole of people who apply general use pesticides primarily or solely, and that they're not required to have a license, and therefore have no check on their understanding or their ability to or willingness to read a label. And yet many of these general use pesticides are in the list of the most highly toxic to honeybees. They may be safe for mammals, but they under certain circumstances can be very toxic. And so I think that's like a loophole, and I'm not too sure exactly how to attack it, but I do think that we'd be remiss if we didn't figure out a way to make sure that the people that are using those materials which are highly toxic to pollinators didn't receive some kind of a education or some sort of input on as a minimum. As a maximum, we might require them those pesticides to become restricted use because of the definition you sent me, which is in here. I'll just pass these around. The last page is in ORS already, and it seems to indicate that the department does have the authority to restrict use of chemicals if, in fact, they are shown to be injurious to not just mammals but also pollinators and aquatic life and et cetera. So at any rate, those are maybe the two ends of the spectrum of possibilities. So it's the last page is what I'm on here is what I'm talking about, this short little paragraph here. So the other thing that I'm concerned about is that those people who are home users and who wouldn't get any training under any of the possible commercial applications you're talking about, or forest or landscape or anything. And so my question in that area is what authority does the state have to require additional labeling over and above what the manufacturer is already required to do because of EPA and so forth and so on? I'm specifically talking about something. Well, the comment was made by Senator Thompson that the homeowner is just trying to find out how much to put into a, you know, they're 20 pages, how much to put into a gallon. And so if we had just something really simple that would be either the first page or a hang tag or a sticker that just would, where appropriate, would give specific, clear, short direction on this is dangerous for. I mean, does the state have the authority to require that? Is that a nightmare to require that on the state basis if we decided to do that?
Well, on some level, we kind of already did that with the linden trees. That, as you can imagine, especially when you have hundreds of labels, is something that states don't do very often. It was really the first time we really did it. And because the labels are national, it's something that is highly discouraged. Probably the way that most agencies go, even if they were to make something restrictive use, let's say the state of Washington has certain 2,4-Ds that they consider restricted use, is they put that in statute, and then they educate people on that particular fact. As far as putting some kind of hanger thing on a container, We would have to have EPA approve that, because anything that goes on that pesticide label has to go through EPA, and it becomes part of that labeling. We are in a position right now, though, if you have recommendations, EPA is in this flux period, and I'm going to be actually there the day that you're meeting next time. If you have a specific recommendation, I would be willing to take that back, because really we want this sort of thing to be national, right? If you had a warning that you wanted on there, I'm just concerned that it wouldn't go through if we just had it as a state situation, if that's your goal, especially with homeowners.
Well, I'm struggling with homeowners. How to get, you know, I can see some ways that we could get to applicators and even people, farmers that use only general use. I can see some possibilities there, but I am clueless as to how to get to homeowners without this kind of intervention on the label. And it's, and I don't want to say that it's not important, but in a way, you know, the person who buys a small bottle and uses it once or something like that, and the impact on the environment, although locally may be drastic, it's probably not going to affect the environment in general in a way that a large application on a commercial basis would or could. So I'm not too sure how really important it is. I mean, it is the question, what do we do about these people? And you have master gardeners that are giving them good advice, but how many people call?
California had tried to deal with that. It's like a third rail in politics. As soon as you start talking about regulating homeowners, it is a huge black hole. No state, including California, has the funding or the regulatory authority to want to touch it. But I would like to say a couple things about homeowner. We have to remember, it was a week or two ago, there was a newscast about many parents can't even measure medication for their kids properly. So these are the same ones that are applying pesticide in the backyard. So I think the educational component is very critical. But I have a question I want to back up even further. In the beginning, you were talking about the exams change to reflect what's been going on, like pollinator issues. Does ODA communicate with any of the other agencies like OSU or the nursery associations to say, these are going to be our new issues, by the way, stop concentrating on training in these areas? Is there any communication in that? I'll get back to your question.
Yeah, not a formal education. We do meet with stakeholder groups, for example, our general pest exam. We're going to be incorporating more bed bug questions. And so we have met with industry members to let them know that this has been expressed as a concern. And so people in general, at least at a higher level, know that this is coming. We do change our study material. And so we do that level of communication.
You don't change the study material on any basis. You just have a broad base and say, study this manual. The questions are going to come from there.
Yeah, well, at least.
So your emphasis might be 1 year on pollinators, and next year it might be on salmon.
Well, not on the exam. The exams don't change that frequently. I think that once we go from kind of this paper-electronic combination, that we'll be able to change the exams more frequently to address current, more germane topics. And so if we do go through a change, that's actually a really good question. I mean, we communicate with that specific industry to let them know that we're going to be changing things. But I'm trying to remember when I was giving presentations to people, about the importance of pollinators, how often we said, other than newspaper articles, that we're going to be changing our exams. It probably we didn't say every time we gave a presentation that we're going to be changing our exams to include more pollinator questions. It's kind of like a heads up. So that's something that I think that we could do more of.
Okay. I wonder, follow up on what you were saying about homeowners, if I may, because we have, when I was down working for the agriculture down south, we have many discussions on this. And I think what we have here is a situation where we might want to consider it, and that is, they have, in Oregon, we have a number of agencies already in place to reach out to the public. We have the Extension Service, which includes the Master Gardener and a lot of the others. We have the Nursery Association, because we have nurseries that sell this stuff. In other words, if there can be an educational component created for the public that's disseminated through OSU, through the nurseries, through the big box stores, if you have the same message coming out repeatedly to these people, they're more likely to respond to it than if they see a flyer from the Nursery Association and 6 months later they see something totally different from OSU. So I think that coordination is going to be critical to whatever public outreach we have to the public.
Funny you should say that.
Ame on the phone, I just I want to reiterate, I think that Rich just made an excellent point. You know, especially the state has the ability to create a consistency and a clarity in order to disseminate quality information out to the general public. And I think that's a great place for us to be able, and then to then take it to all those different areas that he mentioned. And I think that's a really good point, because otherwise people are going to take voluntary actions and they're going to be doing their best, but it won't have that consistency and the clarity that's really what's needed to make a difference for the public to create, to change. So that's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Amy.
And it's pouring rain here, so I can't hear all that well, but I'm trying to keep up.
So, Amy, I just want to make sure I'm clear. Are you saying that OSU or ODA developed those educational materials?
Oh, I was strategically vague. No, you know, I think that's a conversation for us to have. I think ODA and OSU both have different and important qualities to be able to provide input. I mean, you at ODA, your knowledge of the labels and the regulations is so great, and then at OSU, we've got the IPM and information on alternatives and best management practices. And I think a collaborative effort, and maybe clarifying which parts fit best for which entity. But I think both of you have really important skills to add to the mix.
I think in addition to ODA and Oregon State, we should include some of the other major groups like the Nursery Association, because you're going to be hopefully one of our major dissemination points. Mm-hmm. But if we do that, we can incorporate it into the Master Gardeners. I mean, a lot of times we have farmers markets, and there's a plant clinic, which is an excellent place to hand this information out to people come. So there is a lot in play. We just need to take all these little pieces and build something. I don't think it's necessary to reinvent another wheel.
So let me throw something out. I did a little field trip last week. Can you hear me okay, Omea?
I can. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And Scott here, too?
No, he's on vacation, I think.
Okay. So I took a field trip because I've really been thinking a lot about, and it's exactly what you're saying, is we have a lot of good information available. We have a testing mechanism, and we keep talking about outreach. And so I'm really wondering, well, what would outreach mean? You know, how would we get people to know, for example, to talk to the Extension Service if they have questions? Is there something we can put on a hanger? Is there an app for that? Or what would this outreach really look like? Would there be advertisements to help raise awareness? So I went to a creative company that does this kind of design work, and they actually, as a coincidentally, had worked on the pesticide stewardship thing. I'm missing one word out of that phrase.
Pesticide Stewardship Partnership?
That's the one, yeah, PSP. All right, good, I can do that. Anyway, they'd worked on that, so there was actually somewhat of a similar issue to what we're talking about. And so they are drafting up a proposal that I can share to what would messaging look like, what would some of the components of a campaign look like, and the proposal to be implemented will cost some money, and I need to find out if who has money and that sort of thing. But ballpark figure, 25 to 30,000, we could have something that was designed, reviewed by people at CARE, and then you figure out, okay, then the cost of implementing and so forth is beyond that. But it would give us something to look at that, that I think is necessary, because otherwise we're just kind of talking in general statements. So, and but the things that, just one last phrase, they talked exactly about what you said, which was, you know, working together with OSU, ODA, the Nursery Association, the Pollinator Partnership, all of these outfits, looking what information's available. How do we raise people's awareness so that they know where to go for information? How do they, how do you just get them aware? Because you can't expect them to change their behavior if they don't know there's a problem. So. And I kept thinking of Smokey the Bear during the whole conversation. But anyway, so that's my my homework, and I would really love to pursue that.
So you're thinking about paid and kind of PSA?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of stuff? Yeah.
PSA and probably a little bit beyond that, where, I mean, PSA, I think of TV ads or billboards or the Smokey the Bear sign out in the woods or whatever, but if there's other, whatever other communication vehicles there might be, and how would those tie together, what would that message look like? So.
Can I just
George Hansen said something earlier, and I couldn't understand Rose's response, but it was targeting the outreach to consumers at the point of sale, and actually, I think it was actual label changes or supplemental labels, and I couldn't understand Rose's response, and I wasn't sure if there was concern as if that was possible, but could someone clarify for me, because I couldn't hear that.
Yeah, this is Rose. It's very...
Can you hear it well now? Am I?
I can. Yes, thank you. I can.
Any change to the label, any kind of little hanger, anything that goes on that label has to be approved by EPA. We had to get permission from EPA to have the change prohibiting use on linden trees. The pesticide registrants actually had to send in revised labels to EPA to add that. So it's not an easy thing for a hanger. People can, however, put information all around the pesticide container. If they want to put something on that shelf, they can. You know, I know that, I think maybe California tried to educate the sellers of pesticides at these big box stores. I don't know how successful that was. Because of staff turnover, but there can be all kinds of efforts that way. You know, another change that somebody could do, and this is harder for homeowners sometimes to know about, although the regulated public, that people with licenses, even though the public is regulated, is to go through some kind of statute change and to go that way, but then to try to educate homeowners on some kind of change is also kind of a challenge.
And Betsy, at the meeting, I'd be curious, you mentioned training the trainers. And one of the things that has been brought up, I don't know whose idea it was, but I thought it was interesting, is training the people who might be at those big box stores selling products. And I'd be curious what her constituency and what stores would think of that.
Unfortunately, Betsy isn't here today.
Emma,
is that question for Betsy?
She's not here.
Yeah, she's not around today.
Okay.
Yeah, in other states, other state lead agencies have attempted to do that, and the response hasn't been very favorable because of staff turnover in those big box stores, but often they are the people that the public is talking to for pesticide advice. And
then as George mentioned last time, I mean, you can just go check out yourself as well, right? Some stores like Home Depot where you can scan your thing and get out, then no one is talking to you about your pesticides. So there are issues like that as well.
Of all the things that have been talked about, if we had a document or a message that was not too big, and if we had cooperation from retailers so that that could be prominently displayed next to the counter, and if people wanted to take it, they could, it would be better than having it at the checkout stand because there's just so many things there already. It's not going to get everybody, but it certainly would get many people who would, if you could make sure that it would catch their attention. I just mentioned that that's something that's probably doable. I don't know how many retailers would cooperate because it is shelf space, but I think that's doable. Some of the other stuff I think is unlikely.
Well, and that's why I mentioned this idea of having professional communication people that do this. I've got my ideas of what might work, what might not work, and we probably all do, but these people would interview a lot of us.
Who's paying them?
Well, nobody yet. That's the issue.
Okay.
I mean, well, there's two issues. One is that you like the idea. Does it make sense? And if it makes sense, then where can I find some money?
Yeah, I just wonder about legally, like, if we can just, like, pick a company and then I think I'm just wondering about that. I feel like we
and that was the other question three
RFP
is I don't know the
that.
Process.
Yeah.
But there could be somebody outside this group that has money, that has curiosity and thinks it's a really good idea, and they could just go off and just pay for it, right?
Yep, that's true.
Yeah. Some generous people.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear Christy. I'm sorry, what did you say?
It's really not that important to me. I was just asking logistical questions about how we would pay the company that Rep. Reardon has looking into communications. But we didn't settle it.
Well, no, money's pretty important. That's good.
Yeah.
I made no promises to this group, by the way. I want you to know that.
Good.
It's just...
I mean, it's like what probably needs to happen, right? If we're going to have materials, somebody needs to make them.
I think it's a great idea because you're hammering with information. I think that's really needed, but yeah, we need to see how it has to go forward.
Yeah.
I just want to follow.
I just want to raise, I know I'm not in charge, but I just wanted to raise the time. We're over time on the segment. Somebody needs to do that sometimes, I guess.
Yeah, George, last one.
I wanted to get a response from Rose on, realistically, this ORS 634-006-21 that I told you about. It's a description, a definition within ORS of restricted use pesticide. Any pesticide or device which the department has found and determined to be so injurious or detrimental to persons, pollinating insects, bees, animals, crops, wildlife, land or environment other than the pests it is intended to prevent, destroy, control or mitigate, that additional restrictions are required. So right now, as I understand it, the other language which you highlighted for me, a lot of the reason for things being called restricted use is determined by EPA already when it comes to you. And it's really, although you apparently have authority, you haven't really gone beyond what has been fed to you, and you follow through with your mandate of primacy. But do you have, or I mean, what's your response to the apparent, to me anyway, the apparent discrepancy between having general use pesticides that are highly detrimental to pollinating insects, bees, animals, or crops, and so forth, and what, if anything, is likely to be done about that at the department level?
I think that there would need to be a great deal of conversation. There's another section in there when I was, you requested some information about, seemed like another section had limited to, okay, highly toxic.
But that was for human.
To human beings.
To human beings. But this definition goes beyond that.
Sorry, I didn't mean that. Well, that is actually a very difficult question to answer. I think that it would be one of those highly controversial things that would require a lot of input from a lot of different stakeholders. I don't see the department making a decision. I mean, as a state agency, what we usually do is meet with all of the affected parties and concerned citizens and try to figure out the way that this would look. And so I don't see us just making the decision in isolation. We would definitely be working with other people, including beekeepers such as yourself.
Well, my personal feeling is that far from wanting to take tools away from people who need them, on the one hand, and on the other hand, burdening the department with a cumbersome, even more cumbersome process unnecessarily, I still haven't heard any idea on how to make sure that people who are not licensed in any other, for any other reason, and they're mostly farmers probably who are using general use pesticides, how can you target them for information on pollinator protection? And that's what I want to get to, but I don't want to take tools away. That's not my purpose, and I don't want to make the department have to rewrite a whole bunch of rules and stuff. So anyway,
the first thing that comes to my mind when I hear that is enforcement.
This is what the city quarter group talked about earlier before we created this task force, and it was, we kind of recognizing the difficulty of making things restricted use, started talking about, well, can't we use the method that's already in place of licensing people who are using these on a regular basis as part of their employment? You know, we already have some general use products. If they're applied on a third party's property, have to be licensed. So, you know, extending that and using the system we already have to license people who are using these on a regular basis, to me, makes sense. And it also gets to, you know, Reardon's desire to not just hone in on one set of chemicals, but actually give the people using these products the information they need to be smart, both to protect themselves and the environment, including pollinators. So, I would really like to think about that. It is the system that the state and that was federally there for to inform applicators. And these farmers and these guys working in nurseries are applicators. I think that makes it, to me, it's very logical, but that's how I would work on it. I don't know about your other people.
The issue that comes to my mind is enforcement. In my discussion with Rose, I found out that the county that I was responsible for had more pesticide inspectors than she has for the whole state.
Yep.
California has probably 1,000 to 1,500 pesticide use enforcement inspectors. You're going to need that many if you start regulating homeowner pesticide. I totally agree with you. I do. But, you know, who is going to do this? Because that will take more money than everything else we're discussing all put together, multiplied many times. So we have to address that.
Actually, I was thinking about people who are applying these in the course of work on a regular basis. You know, not the custodian at the bank who's putting bait down for ants, but the person who works at the nursery who is applying these chemicals on a regular basis. Some nurseries, I bet, Jeff, you could speak to the percentage, but a lot of nurseries do have license applicators. It isn't that, it wouldn't be that radical to increase them if you're using it on a regular basis to have more of those people licensed.
Well, I
think it would help, would allow ODA, when they did those robocalls about tilia trees, it would have reached a larger audience of people who are using it on a regular basis. You know, and people that, so I wasn't including homeowners. I was including people that were doing it in the course of work.
I'll be succinct. I would say that when this first thing broke, there's actually far more that are not licensed and use general pesticide products than were licensed. That was a revelation to me. And these folks who use the general purpose pesticides do use an integrated pest management system so they can be very effective in their pest and disease management. So I hear...
Nursery
okay. Folks.
But not necessarily farming.
I will only speak under knowledge of what the nursery folks do and do not do. I think there, as we look at trying to build blocks and recommendations, education to the general use folks is one that we'll have to do regardless, because there are always going to be, right now we're in the pollinator side.
Right.
There's going to be something else that's going to require additional continuing education. So how do you then identify where those gaps are? Because I can certainly say that when the pollinator thing hit, it got the nursery industry's undivided attention. But I would say that I'd focus more, for me, my perspective is focusing more on the education side than moving these particular classes of pesticide into restricted use. I think
I'm willing to do that. I'm looking for the way to get to, now in the nursery industry, perhaps you know a way, but the answer I got when I asked about who are the people who probably don't have a license but are using general use, the biggest group you identified were farmers. Yeah. And so if education is what we're trying to do, how do you get to that group? That's all. Like I said,
I see that the licensing an applicator is that education. I mean, that's your certification that you know what you need to know. And the next thing that pops up, it might not be pollinators, whatever it is, you're going to get that through your continuing ed credits. I mean, it's the system we have to educate the people who are using these on a regular basis for work. And that is the education.
I know, George, I think this is an important question, but I think we still need to think about a lot. I think everyone has to do some more homework, and maybe we can keep discussing this issue in the next sessions as well. Because I know there is no straight answer at this time. Everyone has their own opinion.
He's been trying to say something.
I just want to say that we actually have the list, because we license, not us in pesticides program, but our plant program licensed every single person who's a commercial nursery person.
Yep.
So we have a larger list than Jeff, and only a fraction of these are licensed pesticide applicators. So we can, I think we'd have to look into legally if we can start sending them pesticide stuff if they don't have a license, but because this list is for another program, but for all of the other people that you're talking about, George, let's say somebody is growing some other crop other than nursery, I think it is a challenge. I also do want to mention, you mentioned restricted use pesticides. I'm not suggesting we go in this direction, but I just want to put this out there, that some states have limited it to size. And so if somebody is just purchasing a small container of pesticide, then that's not restricted use. Larger size, it is. You know, just to kind of put that out there. And so if you're...
I wondered about that as well.
Yeah.
Could you repeat that, Rose?
Well,
about the size of the...
Yeah. And I think this is...
And if a commercial, I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, I think that this is what Washington does. I know I've seen this with other states, that because it is so difficult to regulate homeowners, for some of the reasons that Rich brought up, that they make the larger container sizes or the higher concentrations of the product restricted use. And so if somebody wants to buy a little container of ready-to-use product, then that is general use and the homeowner can purchase it. If they wanted to purchase a large container of highly concentrated product, then that would become restricted use.
Okay, I think...
That's not the case in Oregon, though. That is Washington, you think?
Yeah, I'd have to check that. But yeah, you are correct. That is not the case in Oregon.
Question. Quick question. You said you have a larger list than Jeff does of applicators. Do you, being ODA, have a list of all the farmers, or does somebody know?
We have lists of people with like agricultural scales, gas pumps, nurseries. We license a lot of different people, but as far as the general farmer, We don't.
It's part of our nursery license application. So part of that nursery license goes, we tax ourselves to do inspections, especially for pest and disease issues. So we build in a lot of different attributes. But she's right, not all of them are OAN members, but in order to be able to operate a nursery, you have to have a license.
Trying to figure out how do we identify the users of the material. So.
Yeah, I wish we had the contact information for all people. I'm sure the Farm Bureau would have a certain sector, Oregonians for Food and Shelter, OAN. And before we move on, I just want to mention that, and maybe Rich has a comment on this, that we do have a brochure as far as protecting pollinators from pesticides. To my knowledge, no retailer has put this out, but we would make this available to retailers.
Yeah, we can come back to this topic again. I guess I know it's very important, but yeah, because of time constraints, we still have to go and look for other topics as well. So the next one here is overview of other states and countries' pesticide laws and regulations. Rich, you want to go ahead with that? And Amai, I don't know, are you also sharing some information with Rich?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't know if she was going to say something.
She left.
Basically speaking, without trying to repeat this, the pesticide regulation, EPA oversees it all. But EPA does give the states a significant amount of leeway in regard to training, certification, and some on the labeling. I speak primarily from California because that's where my experience is, and that's sometimes used as the example. In California, the pesticide use enforcement is done on the county level. Each of the counties in California has an agriculture department. A few counties are joined, but basically most of the level, under nursery, pesticide use investigation, all those things are done down on the county level. That was my remark earlier when I said we have probably, I had to give you a number, maybe 1,500 inspectors in the state of California whose sole function is to do pesticide use enforcement, which be regulation, field inspections, and so forth. I don't know how many dollars we're going to have.
I think we're up to seven now.
Eight?
No, we're
eight.
Down to seven.
Okay.
Down to seven, but we'll get eight for the entire state.
So in my county alone, I had more than she has for the whole state. So, you know, we can't speak on the same level in regards to enforcement. which is why when I talk about these things like the homeowner, we have to look at a voluntary basis, because even California can't touch that. But back to California, the other thing that I think is important here in regard to the pesticide regulation is how it is funded. But the funding is very different. Rose spoke of the mill tax. California has had the mill tax for quite some time now. It's up to about 27 mil. That is, for every penny of pesticide sold, a certain percentage of that goes into this fund. That fund supports California DPR, which is Department of Pesticide Regulation. They are the primary lead for all these pesticide regulations. In addition to that, there is another significant source of funding that's called the Unclean Gas Tax. Now, what that is when gasoline is sold, there's a tax placed on gasoline, and that tax goes for road maintenance, bridge building, things like that. In California, there are a number of groups that say, hey, when I buy gas for my boat, or my plane, or my farm tractor, I never go on a road, so I want my tax back. And there is a place and a way for these people to apply to the state to get that tax back that they pay. There's a significant portion of that amount that is unclaimed. That's what we call the unclaimed gas tax. Caltrans, which is the California Department of Transportation, decides on like a 5-year cycle approximately how much that pot is and how it gets divided up. Some goes to marine use, some goes to airport, some goes to farming and so forth. The farming part goes to DPR and it goes to the County Agriculture Department. So my point is there are a number of significant funding sources there, and I'm talking about big bucks that support the, as far as I'm aware, Oregon doesn't have anything like that. I'm not sure this is a time or place to advocate anything like that, but this might be a place to plant the seeds. Because anytime we look at roads and say, okay, you and your 8 inspectors are going to do this, we gotta be realistic. That part's not gonna happen. The other thing I noticed when I was looking through the pesticide regulation, when I looked at Minnesota and North Dakota and some of these others, is those states that have a significant stake in bees, either because they need them, like California and almond, or because they're a site where they go in the winter, like in the North Central Plain, they have lots more regulations than some of the others. Texas and Florida is kind of like California, they're in their own class. But many of the others basically have nothing. They say, let EPA do it. So there's not much. Oregon is something in between. Primarily because, well, there hasn't been the political will, in my opinion, before to do that. But there is a significant portion of agriculture in Oregon, more so than other states, that is impacted by commercial beekeeping. So we have to recognize that. That's important. Question, by the way? All right. Now that's my train of thought. There was another one in regards to the funding.
I don't know.
Is that in? Go ahead, Amy.
I can't read the room. I couldn't hear all that well. But I was going to highlight just a couple of other policies after we've discussed through Richard. So let's just for sake of the time, I'll take a couple minutes as well to highlight a couple of things.
Okay.
But I want to continue Richard's dialogue first.
Okay. Go ahead. Rich.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I was trying to pay attention to her. Was there a question over there?
No, you were just talking about funding. If you have any other funding ideas.
So anyway, those fundings are significant to California. And I think it's realistic to look at some of those funding sources for here. because, like I said, if we're going to talk about any kind of regulatory activities or perhaps funding some of this educational thing that we're talking about, that's where it has to come from.
So, Rich, in any of these regulations that you read in different states, do you think something we can apply here? Did you like something the best in those?
Just looking at that, something we could apply here. Do we have anything like a mill tax here?
No.
And I know you don't have the unclean gas tax. So I think my recommendation to the group, to make a recommendation that we need to pursue those potential funding avenues. Because, you know, there's only so much we can do on a zero-based budget. Volunteer efforts are only going to get us so far. We have to understand the limitation of education. I mean, we can have the greatest teachers from the nursery industry, from OSU or from ODA, but we have to understand there's a limitation in regards to what the education is going to teach those people out there. I mentioned earlier, homeowners don't want to be burdened with a lot more things. The labels are already too complex for most of them. When I give classes, integrated pest management classes, to other master gardeners, one of the questions I ask them is, how many of you read the label of the pesticides that you buy? And this is master gardeners now. The majority of them do not. I said, for those of you that do, when you go out and buy the same product again that you bought last year, do you read the label again? There might be some changes. No, they don't. That's part of what we're going to be up against. So if we're going to use an educational component to reach these people, we need to keep it very simple. And I think one way would be ask the average homeowner, do they read the label? No. For those who do they understand it? And I think that's one area we could help, because we provide that training to a commercial applicator. Okay, this is what caution means, this is what warning means, this is what, you know, whatever all these things are. They have to know that. Homeowners don't. There is no penalty.
Judge?
Just a question about funding in general. I was struck by how low the permit fees,
the
registration fees were. And you made several comments. You thought maybe it was time to do something about it. I would be surprised if those even begin to defray your costs of running even a portion of the program. Is that something we should direct the legislature towards adjust the registration fees? It's not going to pay for any big program, but it would certainly be more in the 21st century.
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or give my opinion on
okay.
that.
Ask the wrong person.
No, I don't know.
We did talk a lot about it last time.
Yeah, George, we did, and Christy and I did quick math on this side, whether or not you took it all the way up to the statutory authority amount, which was 2.1 million, and then, but to catch it right in the middle, where if you're going to phase it in,
it was if you went to the national average. It was 400,000.
Right.
That's additional income.
Additional.
How much additional?
If you went to the average, our recollection is about $400,000.
I remember that pretty well. It was like 400 and change.
But you could get more.
If you raised it more than the national average. And then if you guys remember, I like directly asked Scott what he thought of it. What
did he say?
Scott said like if it was narrowly tailored.
That's the way I remember it too.
Yeah. And we all could I think what he was basically saying is like if it was narrowly tailored to pesticide related issues, and we all they kind of agreed to the content sort of thing.
You mean the program that is paying for narrowly
yes.
tailored?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay. It was clearly and narrowly tailored. Yeah.
Yeah. Which would be fine for what we're talking about. if it's outreach to help people understand right. pesticides they're using, that seems pretty narrowly tailored, but we'd have to make sure that.
And that's why I didn't freak when the good representative was talking to folks about what a public campaign would look like, because I have no idea how that would get scaled up over, I mean, what you need to do in terms of direct, conversation with the general public to the general use pesticide folks versus any of the other.
So this is Christy, and you know, when Representative Reardon and I just happened to tag along actually to a meeting with him and ODA very early when we were first working on this bill. And we talked about an education campaign. And we also talked about what the fiscal would look like on our bill, which George would have loved. It was the restricted use. It would have moved chemicals into the restricted use category. And there would have been a pretty dramatic fiscal impact. It was a couple $100,000. And I remember specifically that it was like lots of don't mark my words on this, and here I am marking her words on it. But she thought it might be roughly similar, a couple $100,000, to do a similar outreach campaign to what's been done on noxious weeds. That it would be maybe that would be like a program we could look at comparatively to see how much that program cost. And I think they've used that, you know, it's not a one-time, I don't think it's a one-time $200,000. I think it's an ongoing, so they can expand over time. But she did raise the comparison between that program. And if I remember, she said, you know, it could be about that, but maybe not, but, you know, so I can't, just as long as everybody gets it, that I could be totally off. On the dollar amount, but we could look at the noxious weed program as something analogous as far as fiscal impact.
Well, perhaps you've already covered this, and I'm sorry that I came in late, but isn't there any kind of grant funding for education programs of this type? Rich, I know you've talked about that before.
I'm sorry.
Remember, we talked about, isn't there any kind of grant funding available potentially for education programs about...
There are some grants. The individual counties generally don't do that. Most of that is done on a state level through DPR.
You're talking about California?
In California.
Well, I was wondering about applying for grant funding for Oregon for the master gardeners.
Well, sometimes they get these grants, like DPR might get the grant. They might pick a few counties depending on what the subject matter and say, okay, can you develop a pilot program in this particular area? It really depends on the grant. Sometimes USDA will give money that can be used in certain areas, and that may go further. But the county generally don't, especially the smaller counties. We just don't have the time and resources to pursue grant writing.
But if it was a statewide program, perhaps there would be other resources for pursuing the money.
I think here in Oregon, it could be done better on the state level.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
You know, again, I've had my conversation with Rose, and for me, it's still a sticker shock when I realize the difference and how pesticides are handled here in Oregon versus California by the size of the department, by all these things, you know, so... I have to catch myself and say, no, wait a minute, I'm in Oregon, this doesn't work. But I would like to mention a couple other things, if I may, because I can recapture my train of thought. The other thing that happens in California and what is happening in regards to pesticide regulations and training in regards to pollinator health is, for example, you have the California Bee Association, the Almond Board, California Almond Board, and a few others who are getting together to develop best management practices for pollinators that are in the almond groves for the purpose of servicing them. And those best management practices encompass a huge range of things, not just pesticide. It can be nutrition, because bees are not going to survive living on just almond. You know, they need other things as well. I mean, it covers pollination, substitutes, the whole thing. I think there are some industries in here that could be significantly impacted by pollination that it would be good if they, ODA and maybe OSU, can come up with best management practices for that crop type, rather than for us to try to come up with one for the whole spectrum, because they can be different from crop to crop. That would be one. Did you want to add something before I continue?
Well, I know this was in your inbox, but this North Dakota pollinator plan, it's full of voluntary BMPs, best management practices from each side, applicator, farmer, landowner, beekeeper, and it's all voluntary, and it is for North Dakota, but really this might act as a template for a voluntary program of best management practices. So I have copies if you want them in paper, or they are on your...
Aren't we required to develop one of these under the Obama initiative?
That's next on the agenda.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
You can tell I came in late, sorry.
Are you done, Rich, or do you still have some points to make?
One last thing I wanted to add in regard to the funding. One of the things that has driven the funding sources in California for some of these issues, especially the Agriculture Department, is two things. If the feeling is that particular service benefits the public as a whole, it comes from the general fund. If it benefits a select group, there are fees involved and they pay for it. And we try to apply that in many different areas. We're not perfect, but that's something that I think we need to consider here. Because if some of them are very uniquely suited to a small group, then fees might be the way to go. Otherwise, it's a general fund issue because it benefits everybody in the state.
One last.
Okay,
sir. I'll be mercifully brief. The BMP notion is one that is attractive. We've done it on the pest and disease side, where we did it with Oregon State University, USDA, and the nursery industry about how to best tackle pest and disease issues. And we have the really thick, uber technical book, but in the center are the five things you gotta know. And so you can scale it. I mean, we don't have to get tripped up about what core elements are in there. I'm with George that if there's a template that can be easily accessible, then that's terrific. I think you can, when we look at research needs, data needs for the future, if we say that we need to come up with a collaborative approach for BMPs, then let's put that down as one of our recommendations. I'm just saying that there are ways and there are templates with our own as being one that we can show you how complicated it can be and how simple it can be in the same document, because we want to be accessible to the nursery owner who has just one employee versus the person who has a thick binder and does it through the U.S. Nursery Certification Program. It needs to be equally accessible. So that was a long-winded way of saying, I think I agree with you, George.
Even before you read it.
Right.
It really is. It's all.
Okay. Am I? Are you still online? You said you wanted 2 minutes, right? To.
Sure. Yeah, 2 minutes. I'll go for 2 minutes. Sure. I also have some funding ideas and these issues broader than pesticides, but I'll try to type those up and send them out to the group for a later discussion. Since this is kind of what policies and regulations are happening in other places, just food for thought, things to think about. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, initially it was just the Northwest region, but they've just announced that they're phasing out the use of neonics on refuge lands. So it's one of those ideas of self-regulating. It's the same thing that's happening in local government. I mean, no one, including farmers, wouldn't be able to use them on refuge land. Same kind of thing happening locally. There's three cities around the country that have banned neonicotinoids. And so that was just one example of what's going on out there. There's self-regulation. We talked a little bit last time about Minnesota and some of the ways to educate the public through different legislative efforts and also through efforts of, you know, industry and voluntary efforts. Home Depot is putting information out. Minnesota is also requiring, they won't allow, if you apply to neonic or any biodiesel chemical to a plant, there's still detectable levels, you can't put it into pollinator friendly. So there's an example in Minnesota we talked about last time about reimbursing after if there's been an incident. George was really good about explaining the pros and cons of Minnesota, what they have there. Other ideas, in Ontario, Canada, they are now designing a permit for planting seeds that have been treated with neonics. And the reason they're doing this is because they're finding a lot of seed treatments are done prophylactically without a need, and so they're trying to get a handle on how do we get seed treatments in when they're needed, but not plant them when we don't have to, when they're not even going to be managing a pest. So that's something to watch. I'm curious to see what happens in Ontario, Canada. New Zealand actually just refused the registration of one of the neonics that we have here in the U.S. It's thymethoxam. And I think you're all probably familiar with the moratorium on a number of uses in the European Union. So those are some of the regulatory, because that's how I understood, you know, kind of what my directive was on this. Those are the things that I know about that are regulations happening in other places that we could look from, look at, to learn from.
Thank you, Amai. Any questions for Amai? Okay, thank you. So we'll switch to the next section here, Presidential Memorandum on Pollinator Health. So back to Rose.
Before I move on to that, I should mention that our director's office has put in for a program option package for $75,000 for pollinator education and outreach, but there is not a position associated with this. And I know I can't lobby for a person, a staff person, so I won't, but it's not a position. And then Beth was kind enough to send out some documents that I sent. One was from EPA to a group called Sephyrec that I belong to, and we had requested for EPA to change conflicting language on pesticide labels regarding pollinators. EPA at this point is not doing that because they're going through a bunch of label changes, and so it would be really confusing for them to change it at this point. So we still have a conflict on labels in the environmental hazards section versus other sections. Also, I included a letter from EPA to Sephyrec and a group called APCO, which is a bunch of state lead agencies, indicating that because of the memorandum that agencies, state lead agencies, are going to be encouraged to have a pollinator protection plan. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then also I included a letter that our agency sent to EPA regarding their guidance in assessing pesticide risks to bees. We sent this for a number of reasons. One thing on here was really particularly important to us in a guide, and it was kind of buried, like I think on page 39, so we wanted to kind of bring that to the forefront because it was important for us in our linden tree cases. And also we made a request for EPA to have the labels written in such a way that risk is conveyed, that not only toxicity is conveyed, but that, you know, is this material going to last a long time? And also said at the least, if you could put the residual toxicity value on a label, that would be helpful. And I know in the P&W publication, there are these RT values indicated. And that information is really useful to pesticide users.
Rose, I didn't mention this one, but California is either looking into or already requires that residual toxicity information on the products. Is that was my understanding from reviewing different materials. Is that your understanding?
I'm not familiar with that.
It was actually on one of Rich's pieces that he sent out for Rich Little. So maybe I'll look at it again and send it over to you, because that was what it looked like, residual toxicity is, you know, how long after something's been applied to a plant will it still kill 25% of the population? And, you know, it's a very blunt measure. We mentioned it last time at the meeting, but it helps. I mean, if you know that it's not going to be killing them after a day, it's really different than knowing that 2 weeks later you still might be killing up to 25% of a population. It can be pretty informative.
Right. It really isn't perfect.
Blunt is death. That doesn't exactly equal safety, but it's good. It's useful.
And I'm sorry if you don't have this presentation. Do you have it? I don't know.
It's online.
It's online?
It's on the computer, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try to go through it quickly, just because we're running behind. As you know, President Obama issued a memorandum on June 20th regarding pollinators. He started off indicating that pollinators contribute to more than $24 billion to the U.S. economy each year, and that $15 billion of that's from honeybees. Basically, he talked about significant losses for honeybees, native bees, birds, bats, butterflies, etc., and that this was a food security issue. It also could potentially negatively impact agriculture and also the health of the environment. This document also talked about all the stressors that Ramesh had went through as far as the issue with bee nutrition, loss of forage lands, mite infestations and disease, lack of genetic diversity, and exposure to certain pesticides. And the memo indicated that it was critical to expand federal efforts and take new steps to reverse the pollinator losses and also help restore these populations. They did a number of things. One is to establish a pollinator health task force, and that is composed of at least 15 agencies, and that is chaired by the USDA and EPA. Also, they're tasked with developing a national pollinator health strategy within 180 days, which is a pretty short period of time. Within that, there's a pollinator research action plan, which is basically looking at all of the research material that's out there so we can get a better understanding as far as what is going on with the bees, preventing their continued reduction and how to recover. There's also a component of public education to increase the public awareness of the importance of pollinators and steps that can be done to protect them. We haven't seen any of the education materials yet that are dedicated towards the public. I imagine some of this would be for the agricultural industry, others for homeowners and other pesticide users. Also, there's a stressing of a public-private partnership that's encouraging the protection of pollinators and increasing the quality and amount of habitat forage for pollinators. I know that Syngenta is involved with this type of program. In fact, we had a conversation with a chemical company called Syngenta, and they are encouraging and funding actually the planting of plants that are attractive to pollinators, and they're interested in perhaps doing some of this in the state of Oregon. They're in Michigan,
Florida,
California, was it?
Yeah,
and so we might be one of them. I contacted them when I read about it, and they immediately contacted me back. They were very excited about potentially being in the state of Oregon. A big section of this memorandum is actually dedicated towards pollinator habitat, basically telling agencies that they should develop plans to enhance pollinator habitat on managed lands and facilities, including right-of-ways. Also, if they're going to renew any kind of land management contracts or have any kind of restoration projects or grants, that they should look at this as an opportunity for enhancing pollinator habitat. Now, this might not be that important for some states, but it's actually really important for the state of Oregon. If you ever looked at a map of Oregon to see how much land is actually owned by the federal government, it's a big chunk of land. And so this actually can have a very large effect on us. Also, landscaping at federal facilities shall use plants beneficial to pollinators. I don't think that this has happened at the state level, but I can tell you that I asked our groundskeeper in front of our building why he was mowing the lawn at 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said that they have been told not to mow the lawn when the bees are present, because we don't use a lot of herbicides on state property. And so there's a lot of clover. And so even at the state level, it's gone out to the landscapers. And I think all these little things actually do add up. Within 90 days, they have to develop best management practices to enhance pollinator habitat on federal lands. Again, very short. The federal government is establishing a reserve of native seed mixes, including pollinator-friendly plants, for use on post-fire projects and other restoration activities. Again, that's big for Oregon in two ways. One is that we are a huge seed-producing state, and we produce a lot of flower seed, and so this could be good for us economically, and unfortunately, we have a lot of forest fires to boot, so this can impact us in that way. Also, on the federal government, to increase the acreage and forage value of pollinator habitat and CRP land. We do have CRP land, this Conservation Reserve Program. I know that that's even bigger in the Midwest. Also, the Federal Department of Transportation is supposed to be working with the State Department of Transportation. So I imagine at some point they will be contacting ODOT. If you can imagine, we have a lot of grass along our highways. And so it's their belief that if we start putting in some more pollinator-friendly plants in there, that we can increase our pollinator population.
I'm pro putting plants in.
Well, yeah, this could be great for your industry. And then one section under
linden trees.
Oh no, no linden trees. I shouldn't say about linden trees. Also, under improving pollinator habitat, there's a section that I don't think quite fits, but it's there. And it's for EPA, that basically they shall assess the effects of pesticides, including neonicotinoids, on bee and other pollinator health issues. And I know the Office of Pesticide Program has a pollinator work group, and we have been in communication with them. They're also supposed to expedite any pesticide registration requests for use of products that might control varroa mite, for example, that they should kind of put those on the front burner. And that they're to engage state environmental, agricultural, and wildlife agencies in the development of state and tribal pollinator protection plans. That happened on August 12th. EPA did send a letter, and you have a copy of that letter, requesting input on the necessary elements and approaches for establishing pollinator protection plans. And the letter that we received was not exclusively honeybee focused. It did include references to native pollinators. We also, because I'm part of a national group, there's a group of state lead agencies, and I had received a draft of a guidance for state lead agencies for the development and implementation of managed pollinator protection plan. And this was just focused on honeybees, so I think it would just be kind of a component of a greater program. But some of the elements that were suggested, and I think this is really important for this group, recommendations for formalized agreements between beekeepers and crop producers and property owners. Also, there it should be developed a method for growers or applicators to know if there are beehives near treatment sites. So, you know, if you are raising a certain crop, your bees are gone, your neighbor has a crop, his or her crop is still in bloom, the bees are still there, that there needs to be a mechanism to figure out that that person still has bees. A method for growers and applicators to identify and contact beekeepers quickly and effectively, recommend a time frame for notice prior to application. George, it seemed like a lot of beekeepers were unhappy with that 48-hour period. And so whatever plan a state were to come up with, they'd come up with something that their beekeepers and growers felt comfortable with, and also the ability to deal with unknown hives. Apparently in some states, beekeepers will put hives really close to the property line of a blooming crop so they can get the benefit and produce honey. But in the meantime, that farmer has what he or she might consider trespassing bees. They want to make an application, but there are all these bees next door that somebody just put for the benefit of honey production. And so that estate needs to figure that all out. And how do you deal with that kind of thing? Also, that the state would have to come up with recommendations to growers and applicators on how to minimize risk to bees and how to comply with some of the crop-specific pollinator restrictions that are on pesticide labels. In any event, that the plan has to really stress communication, and it has to be developed through a public process, that the Department of Ag can't just sit in a room with some farmers develop a plan that they think would work, that they have to involve beekeepers, they have to involve the public and everyone else, and that this plan would need to be periodically reviewed and modified if it needed to be modified. So that's what I have for that.
Questions? Yeah.
I think some of the things that were in this tie in directly to what we're trying to do here, and I think we can follow some of the recommendation. The one I really would like to emphasize again is using right-of-ways, whether it's roadside, railroad, power lines, what have you. In this state, we have a lot. And I think it can go a long way towards increasing the habitat we need for all pollinators. Another way to look at these things, like the power lines and the railroads and the roads, is they can create what we refer to as pollen and pollinator corridors that enables a pollinator to move from one area to another, especially if they're migratory. Those are critical, and it would not require that much on the part of these different agencies like the Department of Transportation. If planned properly in the long term, it can save them money because they would be needing less mowing, less maintenance.
Did anybody notice if there was any funding available, going to become available for, they made a lot of recommendations like in there, but any funding to be?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty vague. I don't see any funding mentioned in there.
There was some document that I saw, and I don't think the funding would come to. Okay. Recommends, President Obama recommended it for the 2015 budget, recommends approximately $50 million to go across multiple agencies.
15 or 50?
50 million dollars across multiple agencies within USDA to do a bunch of research. But as far as, I don't see anything in here saying that
the trickle-down effect.
Yeah, the trickle-down.
I don't think so.
Well, that's not completely true. The Secretary of Agriculture has insisted, partly because of this direction, that certain changes and priorities be made, and some money has been available, been made available for some habitat issues already, as just a reallocation of money that's at the federal level already, and then it's dispersed. So CRP programs are being enhanced because of some additional $8 or $10 million or whatever made available at the federal level going to CRPs. And then there are also some other programs that have been set up using existing incentives for habitat growth in five states in the Midwest, upper Midwest. So there is some trickle down from federal programs, and there may be more.
You know, along those, I think you're talking about some of the NRCS funding, because they're definitely, I think, Oregon could, and maybe counties or the state could tap into some of the conservation implementation strategies that are through USDA's NRCS program. There are also conservation stewardship programs, and you know that could some the growers and other people could work through. So there's definitely funding out there for pollinator health that at the state level we could make recommendations or urge counties in different regions of the state to be working on conservation programs related to pollinators. Could tap into some of those federal funds.
Secretary Vilsack, I just wrote it today for my own members. When he did a farm bill update, it was $6.9 million grant to Michigan State and a couple other folks about pollinator health. But I think the point here for us is to encourage that aggregation of research for the issue. And so not only how we direct our folks here in the state about urging Oregon State to be part of that. But I knew that there was a number there, and it was 6.9.
That's a competitive grant. It's called a Specialty yes. Crops Research Initiative. I'm aware of that. And we did apply 2 years ago when there was funding. But, yeah, it's just they have only one or two of those, and there are multiple states, multiple agencies applying for the same money. So
$50 million isn't very much. But actually, roadways, rights of way, federal and state properties and so forth, they already have a budget to manage their landscapes. And if they get direction to prioritize certain activities, they can just simply reallocate. And there may be some savings, as you say, on roadways. If you could plant, say, clover, wouldn't have to be mowed, and you wouldn't have to worry, you wouldn't have to be sprayed to avoid fire danger and so forth and so on. And they could probably have some, you know, they might be able to find some savings by doing that rather than planting tall grasses that create a fire hazard and have to be mowed, therefore, or sprayed. So, but it's mostly, I think, we could just direct the legislature to direct the state agencies to prioritize in some way their land management.
Just us on the federal level. We can do that on the state level.
On the state level, on the municipal.
If lawmakers direct the Department of Transportation or others to start emphasizing pollinator-friendly plant, shift in that direction, it won't happen right away. Because if all of a sudden there's everybody wants to do that, there's not going to be enough seeds to do that. So, you know, but you can start laying the seed to do that.
As we talk about pollinator-friendly plants, the right in Corvallis at the Plant Material Center, there is a lot of research going into what are the plants that we want to be putting. And so when we look into those rights of ways, that would be a great resource to look at the Plant Material Center to figure out what do we want to be planting. And because part of pollinator health is really a diversity of plants and plants that would make sense for our area. So they would be very helpful if that's a route we
want to go down. So, what are they looking for? Are they looking for the quality for bees, or is it just some random things that they can plant?
Oh, gosh. So I had a call with some other staff from Syracuse, and this isn't my area, but that was where they do field trials on what are the plants that are most attractive, that grow well here, that are suitable to this area, that are most beneficial to honeybees and native bees. But I would have to look more into it because I am not the person works directly, that knows the Plant Materials Center. But they do through NRCS, and it's located in Corvallis.
Okay, yeah, I'll try to talk to them. Yeah. Because I see a lot of studies the recommendations come from just being attractive to bees. I'm not a fan of that concept, I would say, because just being attractive doesn't mean that's a good crop for the bees, because they have to look for the protein source in the pollen and the total nectar available. But that kind of research is, I know it's complex, no one has done that, but I know people come because if there is no choice, all bees are going to go to clover. That doesn't mean that clover is a pretty attractive source or a good source for bees. So that kind of research, I know I'll talk about research in my term, but I was just curious who these people are and what kind of research they are doing. So.
And those are great. Those are really important questions, because that's exactly when George said clover, the first thing I thought was, is clover the right crop? And before we make any recommendations, let's look into that. So. Good. I'm glad we have you to think about this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thanks. Any other questions, Amay, or are you done with this part? Okay, we'll move. Should we take a break? I think it looks like people are tired, so. Yeah, we'll take a break and then come back in like 10 minutes.
Okay, 10 till.
It takes a second. There we go.
Okay.
It takes a second for the recording.
Yeah. Okay, so what we decided is we'll skip that best management practices for neonics. I think we already had enough discussion, and unfortunately, Paul Jepson, who was supposed to be here today, he got something else, so he didn't show up. So I'm trying to get him again, but looks like his schedule is pretty busy. He's going to Rome for an international pesticide meeting or something. And so what I'll try to do is next meeting I'll bring back again Jeff Jenkins, the professor that you guys saw last time. He's also involved with some IPM and best management practices with respect to neonics. So I'll try to get him for next meeting, but looks like Paul Jepson isn't available for any of our meetings for now. So, but yeah.
You go to Rome and Salem?
Probably, I don't know.
Is that where our next meeting is?
Yeah.
When?
Rome.
In Rome? Yeah, you can write down that, I guess.
There's no reimbursements, remember.
Damn.
I should ask him if we should meet there for him, I guess. So, yeah, so the next part is mine, I guess. I'll go with this pollinator research needs.
Can I just briefly ask?
Yeah, sure.
Jeff, does your industry's BMP for pesticide use, does it address this issue of that we're just skipping over on neonicotinoids, BMPs for use, or not necessarily?
No, but, I mean, as we can have it be instructive about, you can have a lot of information or that they're essentials for a best management practice for pest and disease. So it wasn't specifically about neonicotinoids, but my point is that you can scale it in any number of different ways. I'll bring it to you the next meeting.
I'd like to see that, but I was just wondering if anybody's aware of anything that, especially if Paul can't be here, if there's in fact anybody that has created such even if it's imperfect?
Yeah, I think I have heard some of Paul's talks before, or some of the folks that he guides there at OSU, and I think pollinators are not a big focus even at this time. I mean, maybe they started something last year or so, but I think the major focus is like how do you use a spray nozzle that is correct to avoid drifting, those kind of best managed practices, I would say, not something related directly to application which protects pollinators. Maybe they could be directly related sometimes, like calibrating your spray tank or spray nozzles, what kind of volume you should use. Those kind of things, I'm pretty much sure they do. I don't know if you're expecting anything more than that.
There was one of the things you sent out with a whole, like five or six things down at the attachments at the bottom, and one of them was a newsletter summary of neonicotinoid effects on honeybees, and it was a trade publication, I think.
Yeah, some Bayer folks, right? Is it from Bayer?
Was it ETC or?
Yeah, I have that paper here. I guess.
Does it have BMPs in the back end?
There's also a Natural Resources Conservation Service, again, that NRCS. They have a manual for farmers and clients on strategies to incorporate bee protective measures into IPM plans. And I can probably get my hands on that copy as well. It's a little different than BMPs, but it's very much the same vein.
Well, maybe just for next time, anybody can think of a place where this is discussed, and there is even a rudimentary discussion of this issue. Maybe we can collect some things, because I think something is in there, and something from the Department of Agriculture. It had to do with longhorn beetles, but it had a discussion of APHIS has a document, and there may, if we can just kind of not forget this issue and see if we can bring in some already existing suggestions.
Yeah, sure. That's the reason I said I'll invite Jeff Jenkins. He has some experience for sure.
Great.
Yeah, he'll be able to provide you enough information, I'm pretty sure. He's a part of that IPPC as well. I think he's an independent researcher, but he's a part as a PI for the Integrated Plant Protection Center at OSU as well. So I think he would be able to shed enough light on this question.
Just process check. I'm not sure I know totally what we would do with the BMP information. So it's just my own lack of knowledge. So.
Well, why is it on the agenda?
Well, I'm just...
It was part of the bill.
It's part of the bill.
Yeah, and I would think that you may make some recommendation that they be developed. You could. Mm-hmm. There are different things you might do with that topic in terms of your recommendations.
Am I understanding that it wouldn't be our group to review the BMPs, but more recommend that that be a part of the solution? Is that what you're kind of saying just now to us?
Okay, yeah, I'm just doing a double check on our thinking.
Me too, actually. I thought that's what Beth was saying, was maybe that we don't get into the thick of that in our group, but we make a recommendation around BMPs.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting.
Okay. Yeah, or maybe, Rose, you have any idea? You see some of these presentations, right? Have you seen anything more specific to pollinators with the BMPs in terms of neonics?
But I'm just thinking as far as working BMPs into an overall pollinator protection plan where you have that, it can be really huge or it could be just small. And I guess it would depend on, who had the time to do what and what stakeholders wanted. I know that different states have like BMPs for certain crops, so it's really kind of crop specific. The nursery industry, that would be probably easier than to try to get one for each and every seed industry and fruit and everything else. Yeah, I guess that's what we would have to this group, and I wouldn't be making that decision, but whether we were going to have a pollinator protection plan and BMPs would be part of that plan, and that some entity would
Steal
need to develop that in a public process.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, then I'll go ahead with my part here. Pollinator research needs, it's quite a challenging topic, but I have tried to put some point. Everyone has this copy of this, probably, right? Yeah. So I have just tried to highlight some important ones that probably we can do at OSU and probably some other labs as well, not just my lab, but and I included native bees as well, and Xerces might be doing some of these things as well. So the first one is rapid bee pest and disease diagnostics. I do have a diagnostics lab at this point, but it's a very small scale, I would say. We do address, like recently when ODA had these problems from one of those Portland areas where I think it was a sandy area where there was a bee kill. And so we do test for pests and diseases whenever there is a need. And I do for my studies, but then again, we don't have the ability to do large number of bee samples if something happens. So I think that's a very critical thing. Probably George agrees that as viruses and varroa, they have a very good interaction among each others, and not many labs are there around the country which does virus testing for bees. And so I would say there is really a need to test for those kind of things when a beekeeper complains that, and this is a mysterious thing, like with the sandy area I see there was no pesticide found, and I said the levels of Nosema and varroa mites that we found in the samples were not supposed to cause a mortality in time of June or July. So then it's up to the viruses, which I can't test in my lab. So that I would say that's a critical need, and I don't know, George, you agree with that? Being a beekeeper, I'm asking you this question.
Well, yeah, I mean, right now it's a huge question, and there's no lab that can, they might be able to identify a few viruses, but they don't know what the results mean.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have any thresholds or
yeah, so critical data. I mean, I'm just talking about viruses here, but again, the even if you find there are like 7 or 8 common viruses we find in bees, from deformed wing virus to Israeli acute paralysis virus, there is black queen cell virus, so many to name. But again, we don't know what those virus titers means. And so there is a lot of gap in knowledge, I would say, in terms of viruses. And these varroa mites that I showed you in my presentation in the very first session, those are pretty critical. So there is a direct correlation between varroa mites and viruses. And if we can't just say that varroa mites present, then if there are no viruses, that's a different issue. So there are several interactions going on, and I don't think at this point we have ability to test viruses.
When you say facility, is that buying a couple of nifty pieces of equipment,
yeah,
or is that staffing and a building, or?
Building probably we can still accommodate. I think OSU probably still can accommodate those things, but it's the equipment. So that's what I say here, a state-of-the-art bee health diagnostic lab means there are people that have to be trained. It's a very skilled technique that people have to use for that. So we need machines for that. So yeah, it involves everything that you listed, except for space, I would say.
Are there others of these around the country?
For viruses, no. I mean, the other part, as I said before, I do run a diagnostic lab as well, where we are doing for some major pathogens like varroa mites, Nosema disease, tracheal mites, and probably we do some nutrition as well. But then for viruses at this point, there is one in North Carolina. They're trying to develop, but I don't see it's up and running at this time.
So Europe, anywhere? Is there an example?
Europe, yeah. Europe has, maybe in Switzerland, I think, there is a lab which does viruses for many of those European countries there. But in the United States, for bee viruses, there is nothing at this time. Am I right, George, or you think? As a beekeeper, he can't send any. If he wants to send a bee today, a bee sample for viruses, he doesn't know where to send because there is no one doing it. So
they just sit in the freezer until somebody comes up with a bright idea.
Yeah.
Maybe we could try this. No, there is no place. North Carolina.
They're trying to develop.
About,
I don't know how far they are.
I can't send them samples right now. They won't.
No, they won't accept. Yeah.
They won't accept.
Yeah, even if you want to pay $2,000, there is no lab that's going to take your sample at this time. So.
Well, the question I had on that, though, was that it seemed to me that you or somebody had told me that there are virus labs at OSU. They're just not honeybee viruses.
Yeah, plant viruses, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is there any way of utilizing their equipment and expertise with viruses in general and applying it rather than start a new lab? Or is that I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, no, there is a potential, yeah. No, those people who are trained in viruses, I would say it takes a little bit time for them to tweak because this is an animal, this is insect virus, so they have to tweak their protocols, and probably they still will need equipment for sure. So they are not trained at this time, but that's a good point. Yeah, we can still collaborate with some of those folks that work with viruses to design something for honeybees. But if that was that easy, I would say it would have been already there in some place.
Yeah.
Like Beltsville, Maryland is a USDA lab which deals with just honeybee issues, and they don't have the ability to do that. So then that makes me think it's more complex than what we are thinking. Yeah, Rich, you have a question? Question?
No, just thinking. I'm going to add something
okay,
later.
No problem. Yeah, so that's about one of those research needs I just wanted to put out
the
there.
Idea of cost.
Good question. So representative is asking me how much it might cost. I'm looking at if it's at least there should be one person. Again, it depends on how much volume we want to deal with. If it's only Oregon, maybe 200-300 samples in a month probably, then just again, don't quote me on this number, but I'm looking at maybe easily some $800,000 to maybe $1 million, I would say.
In equipment or in equipment in person?
Everything, in person and equipment. Yeah.
Can you charge for those services now? If somebody from...
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, then probably we can see that we charge other states as well if the samples are going to come. And So we have to see how it's self-sustainable or not, so.
The pesticide samples are charged now.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to have your samples sent to the Be Informed Partnership Lab at Maryland, University of Maryland for Nosema and Varroa, it's subsidized, but they're still $5 or $10 per sample, plus all the shipping and all that kind of stuff too. So there is already the expectation that you will pay. Pesticide samples will cost $300 or $400 mm-hmm. per sample now, and that has to be paid by whoever's asking yeah. for the sample.
Yeah, the beekeepers do pay for pesticide analysis. And that's the only lab that I'm aware of. There are some private labs in Oregon and California as well. And probably ODA is doing some now, right? But they're doing for their departmental thing, not for random beekeepers sending samples for
no,
you.
No, no.
Who did the pesticide analysis of these Clackamas County?
Our laboratory, and on average, it's for one analyte, so for one pesticide, it's $500. The reason being why our lab is so expensive is we do it for regulatory purposes, so we have really a high level of quality, a control, and assurance. But because we don't want to compete with private industry, we don't take in samples from the public.
Well, there are no private labs.
I was going to say
that do this now. That do bee samples now. There are none.
Yeah, I think they don't have a wide screen. Like if you send this sample to, so the only lab that is there is USDA AMS. I think I listed that somewhere. No, I didn't hear. It's a USDA Ag Marketing Services in Gastonia, North Carolina, and they do test for all beekeepers from across the nation. It's about $352 for a sample, and they do 171 different chemicals. So probably ODA was testing only about 40 chemicals, right, in that Sandy case. But these guys have the ability to screen about 171 different common chemicals that are they think are bees being exposed to. So.
And our lab has really gotten that minimum detectable level down really far, much lower than a lot of other states. So they're doing a great job.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's the only lab. Yeah, the next one I have here is investigating effects, both sublethal and chronic. Again, as we discussed all these things before, I'm not going to spend much time on this, but mostly systemic insecticides. I think there is really a need for that, and as we have seen for the last 2 years in Oregon and other places. So I think there are more studies that are needed to better understand these role of these systemic insecticides, especially neonics as well. And again, I'm just putting these there, but again, it just saying is pretty easy, but these are very complex studies. They take years to come out with some kind of realistic result, I would say. And then studies focused on interactions of multiple stress factors. This is very critical. Again, with we can't just blame one pesticide at a time. So there are these interactions that happen, pests and diseases, pesticides, nutrition, genetic diversity, some of this Rose was showing in her presidential memorandum thing. So these are all very much interacting, and those kind of studies are very complex to design, again, as I said before, for the other one. So, but I think there is a real need for those kind of studies to really understand what's going on. And then bee nutrition, which again, Rich talked a little bit about that, and I think Amai was mentioning some labs are trying to look for some forage crops for bees. And so again, here I would say both basic and applied studies are important, not just applied studies, because we really need to understand. That's what I was asking Amai, that is that place in Corvallis, are they looking for the nutritional quality of the forage? It's not just attractiveness, because if something is attractive, it doesn't always mean that that's good for the bees. Because I can show you, I can have a patch here, and if they have no choice, they're all going to come for this crop or whatever you have there. So it's pretty tricky. It's, again, I'm not saying it's very easy to do. Nutritional analysis and keeping these bees in a certain forage area and collecting that pollen via pollen traps or manual collection of pollen, it's pretty tricky and hard. But still, I think there are ways to do that kind of research where, so suppose Rose says, okay, ODA wants to plant something in their place and they are looking for this. So someone has to test the pollen and also the nectar volume, how much that crop is giving you. So those are very critical issues that in terms of nutrition. That's what I say basic studies are, those kind of ones. But then there are applied studies, which probably George will agree with me. It's when they're pollinating these different crops. So a good example is when they go to Madras in Central Oregon. I think I showed you some results from one of our study when I gave the presentation on the first session. So we have been tracking some of beekeepers' hives. So we take samples of these bees, and bees have these glands called hypopharyngeal glands in their heads that are responsible for producing protein. And that's a very good indicator of nutritional status of a hive. So what we did is before they go to Madras, we take samples as soon as they land in Madras, and then we take samples when they're leaving to see what the protein or the nutritional status of the bees is, because we assume, or it's not any assumption anymore, we have seen, it's a place, hybrid carrots are not a good source of protein or nectar for bees. So they are very much under nutritional stress when they are in Central Oregon pollinating carrot seed crop. So in the past 3 years, we have done some research, and beekeepers do feed now. So we have, at least I know, they know that it's not a good situation when they are in Madras, and they see the bees are coming out very much weaker colonies when they are out in July or August. So we did some research, and we have recommended them to feed, and beekeepers like George and others that go to pollinate carrots, they have been religiously going and feeding protein supplements. So you can make your artificial protein as well. And they have been putting 2 pounds into these colonies so that they can sustain the populations when for that 1 month period. So nutrition has been a very critical issue, and so those are some applied studies. I took too much time to explain just one example here, but those are some applied studies, I would say, which are really useful for commercial beekeepers and even for others who are into bee business, or even those who are really looking for pollinator health. Those kind of applied studies are needed to see what to plant and whether that's a good source or not. So those are some things I would say related to bee nutrition are very critical that needs attention. The other one I have here in my list is bee population and health monitoring studies. And again, long-term studies to do some surveys. We have been doing a lot of surveys as well here in Oregon. But again, when you look at other states and even nationwide, there are not too many studies that have looked at bee population. Maybe Amai will agree with me. Like, we ask how many bumblebees were there probably, or maybe how many bumblebee species were there 5 years ago or 10 years ago. There is no baseline data because no one has been monitoring those. At least for honeybees, there is a data set. I think we have been monitoring in the United States at least the managed honeybee hives for last 60 years, I would say, or more. So we have more information on honeybee colonies existing both in Oregon as well as in the nation. But I don't think we have much idea of the native bees that are very critical for pollination as well. So I think there should be studies that are really needed for assessing the populations. At least we can start some baseline now rather than just wait and do the next 10 years or so. So at least this helps. I mean, someone says, oh, how are our bees doing? At least if you have a baseline, you can compare. But without baseline, you can't just speak about that. And I know, like, Xerces does a lot of conservation work, and they have documented some decline or some species totally vanishing from California and parts of Oregon. So those are some evidence, but again, it's not a huge evidence to show that populations have been in decline. So those kind of studies are really needed as well. So that's what I say here, long-term studies or monitoring of populations of bees and their health. So monitoring population is one thing, then I am talking about health as well. So since I came to Oregon in 2009, we have been monitoring honeybee health at least. So we have been taking random samples from beehives across the state, and we have been looking at, so we have some baseline for that for the last 6 years. So again, we need to continue that, but again, with the minimal funding that we have, we can't do huge amount of these kind of data sets. We can't create those. So there is a need for those as well. I mean, again, everything comes with funding, I know. We can't talk all these different things that we do without any financial support, but just remember that anything that I add here, it has to be supported with funding as well. And then the other thing I missed, probably you don't have on your thing, is which we discussed about pesticide analysis. I think there is a need for rapid pesticide analysis as well. I know ODA is developing some of those, but again, I think there is a need for a larger screen rather than just 40 chemicals. I think it should be a larger screen like the Gastonia lab that does about 171 different chemicals. Because some things we might ignore, like maybe in an urban area, fipronil. I don't know, Rose, if you have seen.
Yeah.
Like fipronil is that in your screen? Okay. So I'm just wondering, sometimes we might miss something which are used in urban areas, which may not be in our screen. And then a beekeeper complains that the bees are dead and we run only 40 or 50 that we think are the suspects. But there could be some odd man out that could be, which we may not be suspecting. So So I would say to increase the screen. I know ODA has done a good job of getting those 40 chemicals done, but so maybe in the future we have to see if ODA or maybe someone else can come up with a good screen, which would be really useful for beekeepers.
Maybe you and I can go over that list and talk about how that was developed, because we don't want to take the time up now, but let's you and I meet and go over that list.
Sure, yeah, we can. Any questions? I'm just trying to read off things from here. But those are some things that I think are really needed at this time, but again, given the funding availability, there are several other things that we can do, but I'm just targeting some of those more important ones that really need a focus here. And then the next part I have is the current programs and mechanisms to collect population of bees. Again, as I mentioned before, we have been doing these surveys. We call them overwintering surveys. Basically, we ask a beekeeper how many hives you had on October 1st, and then we ask them how many you had at the end of March, March 31st. So that's basically looking at the overwintering losses, because that's kind of been a norm for several years. I know that's not a perfect way to do, but most of the agencies or universities that do this kind of loss surveys, they do for that period, because winter is the time when beekeepers lose most of their hives. So during like prime June or July, they're still working on their hives, and the chance of losing a hive is not that much when compared to winter, but they do lose hives in June, July, or August as well. So those are some surveys that actually my predecessor has been doing, and since I came, I have been religiously doing those as well. So we have numbers for those Oregon beekeepers. We do only commercial beekeepers. We don't do the hobby beekeepers, because it's hard to track how many they have, and their management practices are different. There are several issues with those. So commercial beekeepers we have been, and it's easy. We have only 24 beekeepers that own about 90% of the hives in the state of Oregon, so it makes my life easy. So I know George and his family as well. So that's the advantage of having a smaller group that you can, and if he doesn't send a survey back, I do bug him by email, phone, and so our surveys, I would say, are very robust, because we are able to get about 95% participation. So, and surveys, as you know, are not a great tool, but still, it all depends on how many responses you get back. So the national survey, I think, done by BIP that I mentioned here, Bee Informed Partnership, I think they get about 20-25% back, I would say. So in our case, the commercial beekeepers, we get about 90-95% back. So we have been doing those winter loss surveys. So that's one way to track loss surveys. But again, the colonies total, that comes from a different agency, which I have listed here. It's called NAS, USDA, National Agricultural Statistical Services. Again, they do have these numbers tallied. They do this census every 5 years. The last one was done in 2012, and the next one will come in 2017. But they ask for honey-producing colonies. So the numbers that you see on their website would be total number of colonies that are producing honey, and then there is a list of honey production as well. But I'm not sure how they collect. I don't know. George, do you have an idea how NAS collects? Do they call beekeepers as well for information?
They send you the form, and if you don't fill it out, then they call you, and if you
they do
don't answer
like
the phone, then they come and knock on your door. So they work pretty hard to get their numbers.
Oh, is it? Okay, that's good then.
Yeah.
So then I think those are very reliable numbers. So the NAS does survey, and like Oregon has about 60,000 hives according to their number. I think it's a little more, but if you go to their website, I think there are about 60,000 hives. And I don't know, ODA relies on them, I guess, Rose? Does ODA rely on NAS numbers?
I would have to ask our plant division how they use those particular numbers or plant program now. But in the pesticides program, we don't use that number.
Okay. Yeah, so
They use NAS for sales. That's pretty well regarded.
So that's about, like, OSU does those loss surveys. That's the one thing I wanted to mention here. And then Bee Informed Partnership, it's a national extension USDA-funded program. We are a part of that as well since last year. We have a team, we call it a tech transfer team, which basically commercial beekeepers wanted, and they fought for that. And so we have two people that go around the state. Every month they are sampling beekeepers' hives, and those samples are sent to University of Maryland to look for varroamites, nosema, and some samples probably eventually will be looked at viruses as well. But so those two guys operate from OSU. I do supervise them. So it's called a tech transfer team. So
they're doing some pesticide sampling as well.
Yeah, they do some pesticide sampling as well. So those are some things that the Bee Informed Partnership, it's a national program that does it, and then, so we are a part of that as well. So those are some things that I have for today, but if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Ramesh, are you, your research needs list, is that prioritized, or could you prioritize it?
I could, yeah. This is not prioritized at this time, but I could.
Because if we're going to talk about funding, then we would need to, I mean, it's going to be a step-by-step process, and okay. We would need to know what, you know.
Okay. Yeah, maybe next time when I meet you guys, probably I'll come up with some priorities then. I still think that number one is still number one there, but the next ones can be juggled
along.
Okay,
so number one is number one.
Yeah, it's still important. I know it's very important for beekeepers to know what their problems are. And viruses are very critical. Even across the world, if you talk to any bee researcher, they would agree that bromites and the viruses that are transmitted are very critical, and we don't have a handle on that. So if they get more information, I think that will be really helpful for the industry.
I think on the same point, it would be helpful to know, like, rough dollar figures for each of them, because...
Okay, so I have to do some math then, okay.
Well, at least for your number one.
Yeah, or, I mean, yeah.
Prioritized list,
it seems like it'd be nice, because if the top one's like 3.1 million and the second one is 200,000, that's good to know.
Sure, no, I can do that.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, I can do that by next meeting. I think I'll come up with this.
And then slightly off topic, I suggested longer meetings, I had already scheduled a group to come down and meet with the Treasurer and Secretary of State, so I had to go down and do that meeting, but I will be with you all for the whole time in the future. My apologies.
Thank you. Yeah.
Good, nice name dropping.
Yeah, well, it's decent. We can't cancel, right?
And I'm sort of paying more attention to this because it seems to me one of the things we've found in here, what I see the conversation circling around, is more need for information or more need for information collected in one place. So I would be interested, again, in the priorities and some idea of funding. But also, I know that it's not as easy as us trying to get, you know, $500,000 from the legislature and handing it to you for some bee virus machine. I mean, so it would be interesting if you had an idea of different funding paths, not where the funding would come from, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah, I think we can't ask everything from the legislature, so there has to be some other...
Your salary is now picked up by the legislature, isn't that correct?
Yeah, see, my position was, I don't know if you're aware of that, so I think the legislature pays for the salary for the honeybee researcher at OSU as well.
And to amplify perhaps your point, Betsy, I like to see how it's integrated with larger data gaps that are needed research-wise that can be accomplished nationally. So if we know that we can handle certain things that are really important to us, but we acknowledge where those research needs are, this report can advocate, be easily given to our senators and congressmen, saying that we need to fund this type of research. You need to aggregate the research needs. And so how does Oregon fit into that, I think, would be worthwhile.
Really quickly, you already said viruses are like, we don't have anything on that. And the other thing is that nutrition is, in fact, his expertise, and he's one of the only people that are doing that in this country. And so that, to enhance that part of the program is logical and would be an attractant to the state from other beekeepers across the country, and would enhance our reputation, the university's reputation, in his program. So he won't say that, but I will for him.
And then our crops would be better pollinated, and we'd have more to eat.
Yeah. Well, and we do raise a lot of, not just food, but we raise a lot of seed in this state, and it's a huge part of the food security part of it. You know, that you don't have to buy your seed that you're going to plant from some other country or whatever. It's basically being produced here.
Well, if there are natural competencies that are being proposed by Oregon State, I think what you heard in terms of priorities and budgeting, but also mash that up with
your core competency. So if nutrition is a big part, we make the case in our report that it's a multifaceted problem for pollinator health, nutrition being one. When you're looking at your priorities for recommendations coming out of here, you can put dollars into the nutrition program knowing that the rest of it we can call for a national effort, right?
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to get a lab for every one of these things in every state, you know, and so we're going to have to, you know,
but
prioritize.
What does Maryland do right?
But this, those are two areas, one where there's a void and another one where we have known expertise but probably limited funding. So we can build on a strength.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I know. That's why bee nutrition is there, which is my expertise there, but I listed it randomly here, just going with the priorities of
and I would, just to add, I thought Jeff's suggestion really made a lot of sense. What can Oregon add to the national conversation? And because we have so many specialty crops, we really have the capacity to research, just to add another research idea. We talk about BMPs. A real common BMP, best management practice, is what is the effective rate of a product versus what is the maximum application rate. And I've seen a lot of discussion on different listservs, but not a lot of research yet on what are some of the effective rates. And, you know, thinking about neonicotinoids, they can actually be effective at very, very low levels, yet their application rates sometimes are higher depending on what pest you're looking at. And so targeting what are the pests of importance, let's look at research into what are the efficacy rates for some of these products. I know there's a little bit of research going into that possibly in Connecticut, but I think there's a lot to be added. So that would be a nice link between best management practices and research.
Ramesh?
Yeah.
Is there a lot of data out there? You talked about nutritional quality of forage. Do we have a lot of data as far as what plants have very nutritious pollen and nectar?
So yeah, not many publications. I'm just aware of one that is out of Australia, actually, surprisingly. It's a big compilation. It's called Fat Bees, Skinny Bees. Yeah, he titled it for some reason. I don't know. It's just people laugh when I say that. It has. They have tested a lot of different pollens from even crops like cherry, pear, apple. And we did some because one of my students, she recently graduated, so her project was on bee nutrition. And so we looked at the commercial crops that beekeepers go, like almonds, meadow foam, pear, cherries as well, blueberries. So those are some things which are known, actually. But then there are several ornamentals, and there are several others which we don't have any idea on how, what's the protein source, what is the, so just not protein, there are amino acids again. So you can look at a total protein, which we call crude protein, then there are amino acids that are available, there are some sterols, so there's, it's a very complex area, and there are so many things to look at, so that's the reason why you don't find that much information. And bee nutrition was an important issue, but it was not in the forefront for last 20, 30 years, I would say. So the papers that you read on honeybee nutrition are from 80s or 70s. So now again, the emphasis is, so our lab has started since I came, that's been one of the prime areas that I'm looking at, honeybee nutrition. I can send you that link and you can find, there are some crops that we know of, but again, it could be just crude protein. It may not tell you what sterols are there or what other things that bees need as well.
The Australian document has everything. And of course, some of the cultivated crops would they'd pass over, and they're looking at some of the cultivated agricultural crops. But all of the background stuff, you know, their eucalyptuses aren't our background crop. So we don't have any information on what the other, and Western Oregon is very different than Eastern Oregon,
yeah,
and all
yeah.
of that. But there is nothing for the United States, let alone, you know, any even local on that. That I don't even know why that was funded in Australia, but that's really the only place that it's ever been done, and we depend on it a lot, but it's not applicable for the general flora for our area.
Seems like a huge hole.
Yeah, no, it's nutrition is a huge gap. I mean, I know people don't understand, but there is not much known about bee nutrition at this time, and that's what I was responding to Amai's a suggestion about that place in Corvallis that is looking at different forage plants for bees is it's kind of hard to do as well, and that's why people think anything that is attractive, if I see some bunch of bees coming to my backyard, we think that is attractive, so let's go with that. But I don't think that's the right strategy. You have to look for something which is really good for bees in terms of their physiology, the nutrition and those things, rather than just attractiveness. I mean, bees can come if something is there, for sure, because they are not finding anything. In August, there is a lot of dearth, so anything that is available, bees will just swarm onto that. But that doesn't mean that that's a good crop, or like clover or anything that you can think of. So that hasn't gone through in the long term. That's what I debate when I talk to people, when they say, we have a big list of these things to plant. Then I say, is it just randomly you're coming up with this list because people have observed bees for 100 years that these are attractive, lavender, rosemary, or any of these things? I'm not saying they're bad, but no one has really looked at the protein levels in the pollen, how much nectar is there, what concentration of nectar or sugars are there in the nectar. Those are pretty much unknown at this time.
So I'm going to plant something in my backyard within the next week. Mm-hmm. Is it better for me to plant something that's attractive to pollinators or wait for you to do your research?
So right now I would say that's what I'm saying. There's a lot of gap in knowledge, so I would say right now you have to just go with whatever is attractive.
Okay.
Or with experience, what people have seen. And there is some literature for like buckwheat, and some plants have been looked at. Phacelia is a good source as well. So there are some which have been corroborated with their protein sources, but many of the plants that we suggest at this time, any agency suggests, is purely based on their attractiveness, not based on their real value to the bee. Yeah, so I mean, you have no choice. At this time, you may just have to go with lavender. People, yeah, lavender is pretty attractive. You plant it, bees will come for nectar when they need. So, that doesn't really mean, that's what my whole argument is, that's not the right strategy, but we are relying on that at this time.
And the other thing is the succession. You know,
yeah.
If something blooms for a short period of time and then it's gone, you know, the bees have to find something else. So when you're planting your garden, you might think about, well, do I have some early blooming things? Do I have some mid-season things? And do I have some late-season things? And trees, because they're like this, provide more forage than things that are planted on the ground. So blooming, if you're going to plant a tree, you might consider a blooming tree. And if you're going to plant two, have one that blooms early and one that blooms late. I mean, so those are some strategies, too. Anyway.
What we do in class is we tell people how blooms from frost to frost and a diversity, as many natives as possible, which addresses a lot of the things that he's talking about, because then the bees don't get restricted to one particular plant that's the only thing that's available at that time.
Yeah.
Especially if it's not a native plant, you don't know what the connections are. And I'm thinking more of the native bee than the honeybee.
Now that's an excellent point. The diversity matters as well. So that's another study which my student looked at, was mixing all these different pollens when commercial beekeepers go to these different crops. So we started from almonds in California, then we took samples when they were in blueberries, then we went to cherries as well, then meadow foam, carrots. So we tried to have a blend of these as well in some studies, and so we wanted to see if diversity helps as well. And that's a great question to ask, as he said. So diversity of pollen is another thing. I'm talking about total value of that protein that is there again, and then as George said, that's another important point, is the succession of bloom is important. You can't plant something good for that month and then you're done. And then I see another problem with this is some people plant like in patches, like they may have one row of this, one row of this. And I think George mentioned about that floral fidelity, and I think I was talking to you about honeybees are very specific. If I'm a bee, I'm foraging today, you can see I have a video next time I'm going to play and show you guys. So if there are like 10 different plants around, they will very specifically go for that certain flower for that day. So they're very much it's called floral fidelity, and it's only honeybees, not bumblebees. Bumblebees go randomly onto all flowers that they see. But honeybees, if you want to watch a bee next time, watch her. If you watch a certain bee, and if you have a choice, she'll be not going to all plants randomly. She'll just pick that one flower. If it's going on bachelor's button for that day, she keeps going on to bachelor's button for the entire day. So that helps commercial beekeepers, especially the farmers, because that's how honeybees are very efficient. They don't go to different plants at the same time. They're going to go to only blueberries for that entire day. So those are some issues as well. So we have to look at diversity. We have to look at continuous bloom and a good source as well in terms of protein and nectar. So several issues. Nutrition is a very, you know, human nutrition, after so many of years of research, we still don't understand our diet. And the bee has been only studied seriously for probably last 60, 70 years. So I would say there are too many gaps at this time. Okay, I'll not take too much time. Yeah.
Just the really good list that Ramesh just put together is what Rich said, which is native plants, because some of the studies looking at native bees is they will prefer native plant 4-to-1 over other plants, and they actually will not always forage on other plants. So just one other piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, total. Any other questions before we move to the next thing? Okay, so the next one is pretty simple, I would say. Right? It's a task force member's discussion of the draft, so I think Beth will go over the draft that she made, and then we can see if you guys all like it, the format that is right now, or if you want to make any changes, you're welcome to.
Does everybody have there's an outline of the draft report, and then also the structure for the task force recommendations? Anybody need one? Okay, so the draft outline is pretty self-explanatory, I think. Do you need one? Okay.
I have a clean one I've been writing on.
I just pass it around, and everybody can take that. So the outline is pretty self-explanatory, I think, but I took the list of tasks that were laid out in the legislation, and for each one of those, have a consistent structure for summary of what the issue is, what the barriers are right now to making progress in that area, and then what the task force recommendations are, with an opportunity for consensus recommendations, majority recommendations, and then also dissenting views if there is a majority recommendation that someone would like to comment on. The one thing, and I thought this when I laid out the list of tasks, and George mentioned it to me during a break as well, the legislation doesn't address habitat and forage directly. That you may want to consider either combining this list differently, or I think you, given your discussion, would like to consider adding habitat and forage as a separate area, since that has been discussed quite a bit. But anyway, I'm ready for input. If you like this structure, if you'd like to see something different, what do you think?
Are we on this? I'm sorry. Are we on the structure or the recommendations?
You know, what do you want to start with the outline? Yeah. Whatever you want to do.
I don't care. I just wondered what you were doing.
Do you have this one, Betsy?
I do. I have them both on here. Thank you.
Yeah. If you're okay with that, yeah, then.
So I would like very much to, on policy objectives, to include number 4, which would be habitat and nutrition.
Along with that, best management practices, you want to have a nutrition there? Is it task 4, or what number are you talking?
So I think you're looking at the, so the structure for the recommendations, that's just for outreach and education. So there would be a similar document for each one of the tasks that shows under the draft outline.
Got it.
Oh, okay.
So that would be task 2 or task.
Yeah, wherever you want to put it. And you know, it may make more sense to combine some of these. I'm not sure I see particularly a different way to combine it, but you could add a separate one on habitat and forage. Whatever you want to do, it's fine. Fine with me.
Was there not some kind of overall statement of purpose in the legislation?
Not really. It was to make recommendations.
It was pollinator health. Or did it say pollinator health relative to?
Oh, no, that's okay, Beth. I mean, I think we could just sort of like work an explanation of why we were doing that into your number 3 background information.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think that it was maybe maybe it was assumed that it was sort of the overall topic. I don't know, but it didn't specifically call it out.
I have relating to pollinator health and declaring an emergency.
So are they think that's sufficient to justify that kind of addition.
Are you comfortable with the structure, the recommendations? I know we talked a little bit at an earlier meeting about, you know, the opportunity for dissenting comments and et cetera, but any... Like it? Don't like it?
Well, I like it. I mean, you can have a section, you can add a section where there were other issues considered that were not part of the original charge mm-hmm. of the task force, and that can have the same type of directive purpose to the legislature
sure.
as any other section, but I think there will be some that will just look about lining those things up with what's in the legislation and then have us put an entire new section. So here are mm-hmm. other things that came up mm-hmm. organically through our mm-hmm. conversation.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So
I want to make sure I heard that. So keep the new discoveries, the things we didn't anticipate hearing about in a separate section.
Yeah, I mean, I would yeah. say you do it before you go to the summary of recommendations. You can put...
You can put
new information, however, whatever vernacular you want to use. But I think you want to try to embrace some of the conversations that we've had in areas of focus mm-hmm. that were not otherwise anticipated when it was drafted.
And I like that, too, because Section 1 of the bill does, I mean, the relating clause says pollinator health, so that opened it up for
yes.
everything. But Section 1 does talk about best practices for avoiding adverse effects from pesticides on populations of bees and other pollinating insects. So our main body of work was to look at pesticides, but we've come up with some other great things that may contribute. So.
Well, and I think, too, that with that section that you just referenced on pollinator health, the background information is going to naturally mm-hmm. end up with the forage and habitat issue because it's such a big issue. So I think doing it that way makes sense.
Gabriella gave me something which I wanted.
I'll add after you're done.
Yeah, no, I forgot. Gabriella gave me something to read here. So the USDA has designated OSU as a climate change adaptation hub, right? That's what it is. So maybe she thinks viruses increased by climate change induced warming, something can be discussed with some of the labs over there. So even though we will focus still on nutrition, as George said, but we can still find some other avenues maybe. Is that what you meant? Yeah.
Earlier discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, Rich.
When you were talking about these things that we need to do in research, the one thing that came into my mind, it has not come up yet. It's what I call pest exclusion because that's my specialty. When we talk about these bee viruses, for example, or the mites, and you need to test for them, what are we doing to keep them out? I think that's something we need to examine because there are some other mites in Asia that are probably worse
yeah.
than the Borrel mite that are not here. But I don't think Oregon has anything in place to protect the bees. Bees being a very migratory thing, move it on. The best way to spread this disease is ship it down to California. If anybody's got it, everybody's going to get it.
Mm-hmm, yeah, that's a hub for everything. So, yeah, there is a mite. I think APHIS is trying to do, USDA APHIS. They have a program where, it's not a huge program, but ODA also helps them take samples. Like, I'm going to get a kit from Helmut Rogge, who is at ODA in 10 minutes after this session. And So we do sample some of those hives, and they are sent to USDA APHIS, and they're looking for that mite that you're talking about, Tropilalaps. It's a mite on Asian honeybee, which hasn't come to US yet, and who knows, there might be just one day, they may just show up. So no, that's an excellent point. So there are monitoring programs, again. So you want something done just exclusively for Oregon as well, or?
No, some states are sampling for that mite.
Yeah.
Data for Oregon is because you probably don't know.
No, we started from last year. I did some samples last year. We sent about 24 samples last year, and we are going to send again 24 more this year as well.
Rich?
Yes.
In order to exclude pests from other countries, you have to prove that you don't have it already. And so what is being done is a survey of existing pathogens in the United States in order to establish what we don't have so that we can close treaty relations, which would mean we can bring things in, but if there's a virus in Argentina or if there's a mite in Thailand or someplace, then once we've established we don't have it, then we have the ability by treaty to exclude products that might carry it. And so that's what's being done right now.
And that's what I call detection. We have to think of pest exclusion.
Right.
Because right now, we're in pest management. It's here. We have to live with it. If we had in place something to protect ourselves from the bromide, we wouldn't have this discussion.
But we keep signing treaties that encourage trade between countries.
I'm quite familiar with that part.
So I will have a problem with numbers 5 and 6 on the second page. How should we address that? Under draft recommendations?
Yeah, so what I did was a combination of things. Under the task force recommendations, this is for the outreach and education sheet, I put some down based on the discussion that the group has had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to spend time at a future meeting discussing all the recommendations that get compiled and going through each one and deciding whether or not there's agreement, whether it needs to be tweaked. There'll be a chance to do that for all
okay.
of them. And what I was going to suggest that you do is that at your next meeting on September 16th that we pick like two of the topics and do that for those two topics, outreach and education being one, and then maybe regulatory, maybe not regulatory, one of the other topics being the second one. And what I'd like to have happen is for the group to send me your recommendations. And you'll see on the outreach and education sheet that Amay sent me a couple that I've included on this, which are numbers 5 and 6. And I'll designate where I get them from, and then we can go over them, and you can talk about whether you agree or disagree, or if they should be reworked, rewritten. I sent it around.
I just have a quick look. I can give you.
Anything else that you guys want to add to those 6 or 7 recommendations that are there?
So, okay, I was looking at the wrong page. So on this page, which is starts with executive summary,
yeah.
task force, so on that you are going to include as a task the nutrition, okay, so it would be a task 7 or whatever.
Yeah, I think I'll do what Jeff suggested, which is sort of preview that in the background, under number 3, the pollinator health background information, that these other issues have come up, and then add it to the bottom of the task list or wherever. But yes, we'll add it.
I don't know about the rest of the task force. I haven't even begun to try to put some recommendations in here. I just want to see how the discussion was going to go. I would encourage us to do just that, even if we would disagree with one another.
Yeah. I think
only because I think there's no avoiding finding out if you have consensus or not if you don't put stuff down.
Yeah.
And so, I had the same reaction as Betsy when I read 5 and 6. Still, I'm sure that Amy and Christy might have objections to what I might put down.
I'm sure not.
I don't even know if I'm going to be that creative. But I would encourage us to There's no avoiding it, so let's
Yeah,
let's just
I think that would save time as well, because if everyone puts their recommendations forward, then we can discuss and see where the consensus is and where it is not. So, yeah, I think, I would encourage to come up with all your recommendations, so it saves time rather than sitting at the end, and then we may forget some things as well. So,
because frankly, I think we're going to have tremendous consensus on education and outreach. I think we're going to have tremendous consensus on research. And even if there's not consensus on funding mechanisms, the fact that you're trying to come up with ideas and a range of ideas that the legislature could consider is worth putting down, even if a Republican and a Democrat would look at it very differently on a recommendation.
Forgive me if I missed this. That's when we send out all of our ideas. Is there a way you would like to receive all of the information that we provide you?
Yeah, there will be. And so what I thought I would do is later this week or early next week send out to you the format so that you can sort of follow that format, so I can just plug them into the right place. And some of the, it's a little tricky to decide where some of these recommendations go, because all these things are interconnected. So if you'll just identify for me in this framework I send out, which should help you do that, what your recommendations are, I'll just take them and plug them into one master document, and then we can talk about that. And, to the extent we could start to do that at the next meeting, I think that would be really good. So I'll send out the structure, plug in whatever you've got as best you can, and I'll take that and put it into one document.
That's a good idea.
We'll see.
It's going to become a monster.
Yeah. Hopefully not.
Sounds good to all, looks like.
Any complaints about leaving early here?
No, we can leave early, I guess.
Yeah,
looks like we are almost done with this. So I would really encourage you to send your recommendations for each of these topics, and I think Beth will compile them, and then maybe we can discuss them next week.
Next
September 16th.
The only other thing, if there are elements that by reference on the North Dakota plan, what the administration is doing in terms of how they frame some of this, you have some ready-made kind of language that I'll go through and try to commit myself to things that I think cross over well that could help be instructive. But I think there's some work out there that has already been done that
I think that makes sense. And to the extent with the presentation Rose gave today on the presidential memorandum and then the North Dakota plan that George brought, to the extent the group is interested in tying its work to that kind of a structure, that would be really helpful to know that, to lay it out that way.
There's some sort of a matrix that seems to have to occur between what the feds are doing, what we're hoping to approach, and so do we bother putting that into the report? Or
I think you should have I would say yes, Representative. I don't think you can avoid it. I think that you talked about kind of what our role is in this effort, what we can do, what we recommend federally and state.
It's going to come up.
Okay, thank you very much. Then we will conclude the meeting.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.